Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Healthy Skeptic Podcast. My name is Danny Roddy, and with me is Chris Kresser, health detective and creator of thehealthyskeptic.org, a blog challenging mainstream myths about nutrition and health. Chris, how are you doing, buddy?
I'm pretty good, Danny. How about you?
I'm doing really great, but when I walked into my garage, my podcasting studio, I forgot to plug in my deep freezer from 2 weeks ago.
Uh-oh.
So there was spoiled beef fat that smelled absolutely terrible.
You're bringing this whole GarageBand thing to a new level, huh?
It was like cleaning out the deep freezer was one of like the worst moments of my life. Not because, also because it was a ton of expensive spoiled
meat. Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah, but the smell, oh my God.
That would be catastrophic for us. Like, I mean, we buy like a quarter of a cow at a time, you know? It's like $600 of meat. If that happened, I would be really, really upset.
It, like, every single time we podcast, I tell myself, I'm like, you need to like make a note because you're totally gonna forget. And
yeah,
I forgot.
Maybe we need the Danny Roddy grass-fed beef fund.
It's okay, I'll get by. It was mostly fat, which I'm more happy about, but because I think it's like way less expensive. But.
Yeah, definitely. Good.
What's new with you?
You know, just slowly getting settled into our new place. And when I say slowly, I mean it. I'm still sitting in my office, still has, you know, probably 14 unpacked boxes that I'm surrounded by. I've just been too busy to unpack them, and it's going to stay like that for the next couple of weeks until we get the healthy baby product out, which I'll talk a little bit about at the end because it's coming up. I'm pretty excited about that. Yeah, and otherwise, I'm happy to see the spring here. It's beautiful, sunny, kind of windy, crisp day in the Bay Area.
That's exactly how it is down here. It's awesome.
Yeah, I like that kind of day. So I'm good.
Awesome. So this week's episode is going to specialize in the gut-brain axis. You want to tell us a little bit more about it?
The gut-brain axis. Sounds the axis of evil. Sounds, kind of sci-fi. But actually, it's probably one of the most important and one of the most often ignored aspects of health. And I think, you know, the more I see patients and the more I get into this research, the more important I'm seeing it and the more significant I think it is, especially in people who are doing all the right things in terms of gut health and they're not improving. And that's actually a significant percentage of the patients I see fall into that category. So it's one of the reasons that I've been pursuing this as an avenue of research. But
it seems like it's kind of a black box, mysterious like thing to treat. Like, I hear everybody talking about it, but it seems very kind of up in the air. Do you think that, like, is it just because it's so new, do you think?
I think that's partly it, but I actually think that it's related to this, you know, what we've been talking about a lot, that some of the treatments for it are, you know, involve lifestyle changes that are a lot more difficult to make than just switching up your supplement regime or the percentage of carbohydrates you eat every day. You know, and this, I know people are probably getting tired of hearing me say this, but the whole stress management piece is so crucial, and yet it's the hardest thing that we can do in terms of making changes in our health. So we'll talk about that at the end when we talk about how to work with gut brain axis issues. But I'll just, you know, I'll talk a little bit generally about what I mean when I'm say the gut brain axis, because it's complex, but it's also completely simple. I mean, this is probably obvious, but I'll say it anyways. Everything we've ever done in life or everything we ever will do depends on the brain. You know, anything from our capacity to taste food or appreciate art or music or smell, to feel the sun or the wind on our skin, to enjoy activities, you know, to read, to do, record a podcast. It depends on our brain. And if the brain's not functioning well, nothing else in the body will function well, period. You know, and that's so important to get. It's one of those really obvious things that's so obvious maybe that we overlook it.
Yeah, is it the chicken or the egg syndrome, though? Because I feel like foods I eat specifically make me happy or sad, or is that a mental thing? Like, do you know which comes first?
I think the sooner we get rid of this idea of linear causality in the body, the better. I think, you know, one of the coolest things about Chinese medicine is that they don't really, and Chinese philosophy in general, is they don't really tend to see things in linear fashion. They see things in a cyclical way. And in the body, you know, the way they look at the body, they would never say, you know, this causes that like from A to B. It's always this and that, or, you know, and both. For example, and they've always recognized this, that the sort of emotion, psychology, and physiology are one and the same. In fact, they don't even really have a separate word for emotions. Like in the medical sense, of course they do in language, but they look at systems of the body, like the liver system or the lung system or, you know, the heart system. And those each system includes both physical symptoms and also emotional and psychological and even psycho-spiritual aspects. So it's pretty cool way of looking at the body. And I think in that sense, it's actually more advanced than our way of looking at it, which is, you know, like a car with a bunch of separate parts that are, you know, we understand that they're related, but we still talk about them as being separate and distinct. But the truth is you can't really, you cannot talk about emotion without talking about physiology. And you can't talk about physiology without talking about emotion. And they're not connected. They just, they're the same system. So I think that's important to understand. And it kind of makes the chicken and egg thing a moot point in the sense that it's really difficult if there's, you know, if it's all part of the same system, it's really difficult to say which came first, you know, and which followed. Once you're in the cycle, you're in the cycle. So that's good news, bad news, because it means that when it comes to treating it, you don't have to figure out which one. You do both, and both will improve. But you can figure out which one you haven't been focusing on, which in most cases for most people is the brain. And so that you might get more mileage by, you know, focusing on one area because you've been neglecting it. So
I like that cyclical thing. I've never heard that before.
Yeah. Yeah. Chinese medicine, I mean, they're amazingly far, far ahead of their time. I mean, they figured this stuff out 2,500, 3,000 years ago while, you know, we were still, you know, hadn't thinking about things in terms of phlegm and bile and, you know, the Western medicine was like just totally archaic understanding of the body.
Phrenology.
Yeah, we were, you were a phlegm type or a bile type, and, you know, we were, even up until the Middle Ages, you know, bleeding buckets full of blood for people to make them better. And in fact, a lot of people think, you know, George Washington was killed by his physician who just kept bleeding him and bleeding him and bleeding him, you know, cause he was sick, but just kept bleeding him until he died. Anyways, I don't know where the heck we're going with this, but let me get back on track here. Let's the brain. So when the brain's not functioning well, nothing else in the body functions well. So you have to also remember that neurons are post-mitotic, which means they don't go through cell division. They don't regenerate. And, you know, they're like heart tissue in that respect, which is the only other post-mitotic tissue in the body. So when neurons die, that's it. You don't get new ones. Game over. So, for example, by the time you finish listening to this podcast, you'll probably have lost about 7,000 neurons.
Maybe more.
Sorry to say. Yeah, it depends what you're doing while you're listening too. But and the day that we're born, we have more neurons than we'll ever have in our life. So that's the bad news. But the good news is that neurons can develop plasticity. Which means that when you lose neurons, other neurons can adapt to communicate with each other. So you can kind of form these new connections that can take the place in some cases of the loss of neurons. What all of this means is that protecting the brain from neurodegeneration, which is happening for all of us all the time. And when I say protecting, I don't mean stopping because you can't, at least we don't know how to yet. I mean, slowing it down as much as possible. This is one of the most important and, again, overlooked steps we can take in protecting our health. So let's talk a little bit more specifically about, you know, the brain-gut axis and how it all works. You know, the 50,000-foot overview, which somebody on the Facebook page asked for, is this. 90% of our brain's output goes into something called the pontomedullary area. It's the, I think, the lower two-thirds of the brainstem. And that goes into the vagus, or the pneumogastric nerve, which innervates the digestive tract. Now, one of the earliest signs of the brain not firing well is poor vagal activity, which will manifest as, you know, decreased pancreatic enzyme secretion, poor gallbladder function, and, you know, just poor gut function overall. And it basically works like this. You have decreased activity in the brain, and we're going to talk about how that could happen in a second. And that decreases the activation of the vagal motor nuclei, which in turn suppresses the intestinal immune system and decreases intestinal blood flow. And when that happens, you get an increased growth in pathogenic yeast and bacteria. That causes intestinal permeability or leaky gut, which we've talked about a lot. And leaky gut causes a state of chronic low-grade inflammation. Then the inflammatory cytokines produced in the gut travel through the blood, and they cross the blood-brain barrier. One of the problems with inflammation is that it makes that blood-brain barrier leaky, so you get leaky brain. And then those inflammatory cytokines, once they get into the brain, they activate the microglial cells, which are the second type of cell in the brain. You have neurons, and then you have microglial cells. And the microglial cells are like the immune cells of the brain, and they, you know, once they're activated by these inflammatory cytokines, this is basically inflammation of the brain. So your brain gets inflamed. You get a leaky brain, and then you get inflamed brain. And that's no fun, definitely. Because one of the problems is that, unlike the rest of the immune system in the body that has T regulatory cells that can turn off inflammation in the brain, the microglial cells don't get turned off. So when you've got an inflamed brain, it can be really tricky to reduce that inflammation without some outside help. So anyways, you've got an inflamed brain, and the inflammation in the brain decreases nerve conductance, and that in turn causes depression and reduced activity of the vagal motor nuclei. And of course, then we're back where we started. That reduced activity of the brain reduces the output into the vagus, and that causes more digestive problems, more inflammation in the gut, more inflammatory cytokines to be, you know, in the bloodstream and up into the brain, and you know, we're stuck in this really vicious cycle. So, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say cyclical.
Cyclical, exactly. More
bring
cycles.
It back home.
It's all cycles, baby. that this is also why digestive symptoms are typically the main symptom of brain issues. And I don't know if you ever thought about this, but, you know, two of the populations that most commonly have gut symptoms are seniors and autistic kids. I mean, show me an autistic kid and I'll show you somebody that's got a screwed up gut, you know, as Datis Karazian likes to say. And seniors, you know, typically have problems chewing. They have problems with, you know, they have hypochlorhydria or atrophic gastritis where they don't produce stomach acid. They're constipated. You know, it's very, very common to have see digestive problems in seniors. And this is, it's not a coincidence. You know, it's not, there's a mechanism here, and that mechanism is neurodegeneration and neuroinflammation. The other thing that's important to recognize about all this, which we already alluded to, is that when gut symptoms persist, even in the context of a healthy diet, like let's say you've done the 30-day challenge or you're on a paleo diet and you're still having a lot of gut symptoms, that could indicate a brain-gut axis problem. It may also indicate a parasite or something like that, but let's say you've been tested for a parasite, you don't have any. But you're still having all these gut symptoms, that's the brain-gut axis, or the gut-brain axis right there.
Could heavy metals be another factor?
Sure. I mean, any kind of environmental toxin, including metals, could be a factor in terms of agitating, you know, the gut and causing inflammation. And also, as you know, I think you're suggesting, causing issues in the brain. But, you know, the body is equipped to deal with some level of metal toxicity. And there, of course, it certainly are people who have more exposure to toxic metals than they can handle. But I think heavy metal toxicity is also one of these diagnoses that fall into that sort of like candida, chronic fatigue, Lyme disease category.
I couldn't agree more, just because the amount of people with amalgams in their mouth and that are unaffected by them is huge. So it's like, some people it affects like really badly, and then other people it's like totally okay.
So. Right. So this, my mantra lately is, it's the environment, stupid, which is like, we're always trying to find the answer, you know, for everybody. But the truth is, I was just talking to a patient about this yesterday. There is no answer for everybody, because everyone's internal environment is different. So for example, you take one person and they have Blastocystis hominis, which is really the most common, you know, parasite in humans, and they have no symptoms. They're completely healthy, completely symptom-free. Take another person, they have Blasto, they're totally sick. You know, they're like on death's door. So, you know, is Blastocystis pathogenic or not? Well, yes and no. Depends on what's happening in the host. It depends on the internal environment of the gut, you know, and the innate immunity of that person. So, you know, as usual, it's a lot more gray than we'd like it to be. Just a little personal story here. Lately I've been overworking, you know, between, my very full practice and, the blog and Facebook and Twitter, and I'm spending a lot of time on this healthy baby product, which I'm really excited about. It's going to be ready soon. I'm just like, you know, I'm working too much. There's no other way to put it. And not taking my own advice. I have been exercising and doing my sitting practice. Those pretty much are bulletproof. They never go away. But a lot of the other things I usually do to keep my brain functioning well, like just resting, you know, surfing, going out in the sun, listening to music, you know, doing yoga and other stress management stuff, having fun, you know, watching a funny TV show or movie or something like that. I've been doing that stuff.
You better watch out, because Durian Rider is going to write a post about you like he did Rob.
Uh-oh.
did you see that?
No, I don't even pay attention to that stuff.
Well, no doubt he's crazy, but he wrote a really mean article about Rob, and then Rob responded with something really funny, but I don't remember what it was.
Yeah. I try to take the high road with that stuff. I'm just like, I just don't even have time to bother with those people. So anyways, I was noticing a flare-up in gut symptoms. You know, I have this history of digestive issues from when I got parasites and amoebas and a bunch of other stuff in Asia a long time ago. You know, some of you know that story. But I was starting to have gut symptoms. I hadn't made a single change in my diet, single change in, you know, the supplement regime, which is pretty minimal anyways. Nothing else had changed except for, you know, the level of work I was doing and the amount of time I was spending taking care of myself. So I switched some things up over the past week or 10 days. And even in that short period of time, I've noticed huge differences. I feel like I'm back on my normal track again. So just a little cautionary tale. Okay, so what are the symptoms of brain-gut axis problem? Well, fatigue and brain fog are big indicator. We've talked about chronic digestive problems, and especially those that don't respond to dietary changes, you know. Then we have things like progressive cognitive decline or memory problems, which we see in the elderly, of course, but also in an increasingly large number of 25-year-olds. I mean, I have so many people in their 20s and 30s who are losing brain function, which is just kind of scary. You know, it's something that you don't want to be happening when you're 25 years old. Anxiety, depression, you know, ADHD, autism spectrum disorder, behavioral problems. And then here's an interesting one. Cold hands and feet, and especially if you have, you know, toenail fungus. Because what's happening there is that you've got reduced blood flow, reduced circulation to your peripheral tissues. And the brain, when you think about it, is a peripheral organ. So cold hands and feet and toenail fungus can be an indicator of a brain-gut axis problem. And I see that a lot, actually, in my practice.
Does that have anything to do with the thyroid and, like, the brain down-regulating things? Or
it could, but I think it could also just be pure, you know, just a simple result of reduced blood flow.
Wow.
So, and that can happen in all kinds of inflammatory processes. So the basic physiology here is that in the brain, the key players are in this gut-brain axis are the frontal cortex, the insular cortex, the vagal motor nuclei, which we've already talked about, and the hypothalamus. And the frontal cortex basically excites, you know, stimulates the vagal nuclei to activate gut motility, which is what, you know, intestinal peristalsis, what moves the contents of our gut through the digestive tract and out the other end, and enzyme secretion. And the insular cortex contains the somatotopic map, which is basically what lets the brain know where the gut is. And then the vagal motor nuclei activate intestinal motility, and they modulate blood flow, which we just talked about, but in this case to the gut. And then they activate the release of hydrochloric acid and digestive enzymes. And the brain primarily communicates with the gut via neuronal projections and then hormones that are secreted by the hypothalamus. But in the gut, the key players are the enteric nervous system, the intestinal immune system, which is the gut-associated lymphoid tissue and the gut flora, and then the intestinal microglia. The enteric nervous system is really interesting, actually. The gut is basically one big nervous tissue. And in fact, it's been referred to as the second brain. And there's a book by that title by Dr. Michael Gerson that's kind of interesting. It has some flaws, but it's worth reading. And the enteric nervous system also generates intestinal motility and enzyme release, and then it provides incoming input to the vagus nerve. So someone asked about serotonin in the questions and how much serotonin is in the gut. Well, 80% of total serotonin in the body is located in the enterochromaffin cells in the gut. And this is used primarily to regulate in peristalsis and motility. So this is why constipation and depression so often tend to go together. And then the remaining 20% is synthesized in serotonergic neurons in the central nervous system that regulate mood and appetite and sleep and muscle contraction and a whole bunch of other stuff. So the gut communicates with the brain via cytokines and gut opiates and gut peptides like neurotensin and substance P. Okay. Everyone who just zoned out for the last 5 minutes, you know, staring out the window while you're driving or whatever, you can come back now, because we're gonna talk about some practical applications. But I feel like it's important to understand the basic physiology, so that this, you know, what we're gonna talk about next makes more sense. Any questions, Danny? How you doing?
I'm good. I'm good.
You're still with us in your rotten meat-smelling garage.
Luckily, the smell has subsided.
Okay.
Yeah, it was bad, man.
Good. Okay, so how does the brain affect the gut? Well, I know everybody's experienced this in a very personal way. I mean, we have phrases like butterflies in the stomach and gut feeling that, of course, suggest the connection's been known for a long time. And, you know, maybe we all know somebody that has lost complete bowel control in a state of extreme fear or stress. Or, you know, certainly that's in the movies and we hear about that sort of thing. But what are some of the mechanisms here? Well, in the intestinal mucosa, there are blood vessels that are influenced by the autonomic nervous system. And the intestinal mucosa also is infiltrated by the myenteric plexus, which is a network of nerve fibers and neuron cell bodies that are in turn influenced by the brain. So as I said before, the gut's basically one big nervous tissue. And I think I mentioned this study in a previous podcast or in an article, but it was a really interesting study where they induced traumatic brain injury in mice, which is not too nice. But these mice developed leaky gut in less than 6 hours after having this brain injury. Even more interestingly, if the researchers stimulated the vagus nerve, which mimics like increasing the brain output into the vagus, that actually prevented the leaky gut from developing.
What when they did that to the mice, is the root cause, like the brain injury causes stress?
It causes decreased output into the vagus. Because remember, okay, I said before, 90% of the output of the brain goes into the pontomedullary area and then into the vagus. But okay, a traumatic brain injury is going to reduce that output. And then they showed that if by just stimulating the vagus, which mimics increasing the output, they were able to prevent the leaky gut. So they basically proved that connection between the brain and the vagus and the gut. Then you have other studies that show that neurotransmitters like serotonin and acetylcholine are involved in preventing or promoting ulcers in the digestive tract, and that alterations in the brain can cause abnormal gastric enzyme secretion. So I want to talk about a few different studies that I have found over the last couple of years that I think are pretty interesting. There was one published last year in National Review of Gastroenterology and Hepatology, and I'll quote from the conclusion. They said, IBS is thought to be the result of disturbed neural function along the gut-brain axis. So that makes it pretty clear.
That's big news.
Yeah. And this, you know, there's an interesting thing here where for a lot of years, doctors told people with IBS it was all in their head. And that's like really not a nice thing to say, but it's true. The thing is, it's not true in the way that the doctors meant it.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying? They meant like, you just need to get over this, or like, you're just imagining it is what they meant. But what is true is that it is in your head, because that's where your brain is. And if the gut is malfunctioning, then the brain is involved, and vice versa. So it is all in our head, but not in the sense that we're to blame for it, or we're just making it up. Another study in 2005 found that IBS patients have increased activation of pain circuits and decreased activation of pain inhibition circuits. So this is interesting because I don't know if you remember this, but when we had Kurt Harris on, we were talking about fructose malabsorption and the gas that produces and the difference in the way that's experienced with people with IBS and people without IBS. And they found in that study that people with IBS and without IBS had the same amount of gas produced with fructose malabsorption, but it didn't even bother the people who didn't have IBS. It only was painful and you know, uncomfortable in people with IBS. And so that's what this is about here. This, you know, people with IBS have a decreased pain threshold, increased activation of pain circuits, and then decreased ability to turn off the pain circuits.
So they're just in a hypersensitive state.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's not necessarily the amount of gas that's produced. It's how they experience it. And again, it's not their fault. It's not something that they are imagining. It's a real neurophysiological pathway. Journal of Clinical Psychiatry 2001. This is crazy. 50 to 90% of IBS patients seeking treatment have a psychiatric disorder. Whoa. This includes panic disorder, anxiety, social phobia, PTSD, or major depressive disorder. I mean, like, if that doesn't sum it all, you know, give you some strong evidence for an association between the gut-brain, I don't know what does.
I hate to put you on the spot. Is there like a figure for how many Americans suffer from IBS? It seems pretty common, at least among my peers.
The only figure that stuck in my mind about that is that it's now the second leading cause of people missing work behind the common cold. So that stuck in me more than whatever the number of millions of people are that have it. Like, it's causing serious debility, you know, in the morbidity in the population. And, you know, it's right up there with depression in terms of, how common it is and how debilitating it is.
Then the third cause just being a normal hangover.
hating their job. I don't know. Okay, Biological Psychiatry 2009. They, again, not very nicely, expose rats to stress by separating them from their mothers early on in their life. And then they challenge them with lipopolysaccharide, which is a bacterial endotoxin. And the rats that were exposed to that early life stress had increased pain and alteration of their gut flora compared to controls. And, you know, the conclusion by the researchers was that early life stress alters the gut-brain axis and in a permanent way and causes depression, IBD, and IBS. I mean, permanent, I don't know if that's, you know, they were suggesting that it's something that, wasn't passing. It didn't just last for the early part of the lives of these rats. It persisted, you know, throughout their life. Whether that's permanent for humans or can be reversed, that's a whole other question. Go for it. Get it out.
Yeah, I was gonna say, because mice, their lives are so much shorter. Could they say that, like, it wouldn't be transferable over to humans because we live so much longer? Does that have anything to do with it?
I don't know. I mean, I think this is all sort of fairly gray territory in terms of, like, I mean, earlier on it was thought that certain neurological conditions were irreversible and certain, you know, neural pathways once developed couldn't be undeveloped but now, you know, more recent research suggests that there's a lot more plasticity in the brain and in the nervous system than we thought there was, which means that it's possible to form new connections and for those new connections to kind of take over in terms of importance in the brain and nervous system. So my sense is that if, you know, significant trauma early on in life probably would predispose somebody for life to certain, you know, to maybe having a sensitive gut brain axis. And mm-hmm. and maybe that sensitivity wouldn't be reversible, but if they just by learning strategies for how to cope with it and you know, things to do that manage it, they can live a perfectly healthy, happy, normal life. That's my sense, but there's nothing, you know, particularly scientific about that. Journal of Neurotrauma in 2009, they found that traumatic brain injury can cause gastrointestinal dysfunction. We already talked about this, and leaky gut. And then a study in Lancet found that patients with inflammatory bowel disease, which includes Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, had focal white matter lesions, which are these small areas of dead cells in the brain, with almost the same frequency as patients with multiple sclerosis. So how's that? I mean, that, once again, extremely clear connection between brain issues and gut issues. So now we're going to talk a little bit about how the gut affects the brain. There's a lot of different mechanisms here, and we only have time to review a couple of the main ones. And our friend Matt Lalonde actually sent me a study a couple of weeks ago. It was just published, suggesting that the gut flora influences the development of behavior and causes neurochemical changes in the brain. So again, from the conclusion, they said, "We conclude that the presence or absence of conventional intestinal microbiota influences the development of behavior and is accompanied by neurochemical changes in the brain. And they point out that even subclinical doses, small doses of pathogenic bacteria infused into the gut of mice can produce anxiety without any overt gut inflammation. So what they're saying here basically is that the gut flora can, you know, not only affect how we digest food and, you know, whether our gut lining is permeable, but can actually influence the development of our behavior and, you know, one could even argue personality.
I think it was Gershon that said, have you ever met somebody with IBS that's like not anxiety prone? And I think he quote like said, if you were chained to a toilet or something like that, you probably wouldn't be in the best spirits either.
Yeah, that's a very vivid example for sure. But yeah. And it's, I also, it reminds me of the fact that, you know, bacteria outnumber human cells in the body by 10 to 1. So we have 100 trillion bacteria in our gut. I mean, that's 10 to the 14th power. It's just like an incomprehensible number. And so if you look at it that way, you could say we're more bacterial than we are human. When you consider it that way, it's not that surprising that the composition of the gut flora can have so many effects, like on everything from our metabolism to our behavior. So another study by Lee et al. Found that changes in gut bacteria induced by feeding different types of food to mice altered their memory and learning. So they fed half the mice standard rat chow, and then the other lucky half the mice got a 50-50 blend of rat chow and ground beef. And then they measured the diversity of the gut flora, and the mice that ate the beef had significantly more diverse gut flora and significantly higher learning and memory scores. So now we're talking about healthy gut flora making you more intelligent, essentially.
Like serotonin in the gut, does acetylcholine also, does it have anything to, like, could that have somehow been involved? I mean, I know we don't have all the answers to
that. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, Danny, actually, where the majority of acetylcholine is produced. I don't think it's in the gut, but I'm not sure. One of the most interesting examples of how the gut affects the brain is this immune inflammatory cytokine model of depression. And I want to get Dr. Emily Deans to come on the show and talk about this because she writes a lot about it and she probably knows a ton of more about it than I do. But I'm going to give you my understanding of it. I like it because it's the only model of depression that kind of bridges the gap between physical and mental. You know, we talked about this before. In Chinese medicine, they don't see depression as a mental problem. They see it as a whole body problem, you know, mental, emotional, psycho-spiritual, physiological problem. And but for, you know, the immune inflammatory cytokine model, from this perspective, depression isn't so much a disease as it is a sign of chronic immune system activation. And that chronic immune activation produces inflammatory cytokines that in turn produce depression. I explained that at the beginning of the show, how that works. And this was discovered back in the 80s that, you know, cytokines, inflammatory cytokines have a huge effect on mood and behavior. And you would have thought this would have had like a gigantic impact, you know. So it completely changes the way that we look at depression. But it didn't receive much attention at all in the mainstream press or the conventional medical world, I suspect, because there were no drugs available for, you know, for treating it in this particular way. But the inflammatory cytokines that are associated with depression include interferon alpha, tumor necrosis factor, interleukin 1 and 2. And it's, you know, it's important to note that elevated cytokines don't produce depression in everybody, and why some people are susceptible and others aren't isn't really known. But we do know that inflammatory cytokines produce symptoms of depression in some people. And the best example of this is patients given interferon treatment for hepatitis. I don't know if you've ever heard about this, Danny, but...
No.
Yeah, so interferon is a nasty, nasty drug, and, you know, it's... basically, the idea is to increase the inflammatory response so that the body can deal with the hepatitis. And most of the patients who take this drug, they report severe fatigue, like complete lack of interest in life, lack of concentration, and just debilitating depression. And suicide rates are higher on interferon than any other drug. And in fact, one study, there 65% of patients taking interferon became psychiatric patients during the study.
Holy smokes.
Yeah. And the depression didn't stop immediately after stopping the treatment. So definitely a strong connection between inflammatory cytokines and depression. We also know that depressed people secrete greater quantities of cytokines, inflammatory cytokines, than normal people. And this has been extensively studied by, maybe my brain got access isn't functioning. Dr. Michael Mays and his colleagues in Belgium, and they've published like 40 papers demonstrating that chronic immune activation and the associated increase in cytokine production is characteristic of depression. So you have all those different ways that the gut can affect the brain, and particularly inflammation in the gut can cause inflammation in the brain. So the takeaway here is that anxiety and stress and IBS and IBD, you know, gut and the brain, they're all part of the same axis. They always go together. Every stressful event that we experience in life increases the plasticity of stress pathways in the brain, which means it makes the brain essentially more efficient at running stress pathways. And there's a saying in functional medicine, fire in the gut, fire in the brain. Which sums it up pretty well. Digestive function will start to fail immediately after the brain starts to fail. And the interintestinal gut mucosa and the brain themselves don't have any pain fibers, which is why brain gut, you know, you don't see people coming into the clinic going, my brain hurts. You know, my brain feels really inflamed. Can you help me? They come in saying, oh, I've got, you know, I can't eat any foods. I've got, you know, gas and bloating. I can't remember anything. I'm losing my, you know, like I used to be able to concentrate for long periods and now I can't. I've got cold hands and feet and I've got this toenail fungus that won't go away. I mean, this is what people say when they've got a gut brain issue. And as a patient or a clinician, if you ignore the role of the brain in addressing gut issues, success is definitely going to be limited. And, you know, probiotics and HCL and diet are all important, very important, of course. But it's possible to do all of that right and still have gut symptoms, as I've experienced directly myself and as a lot of my patients have experienced. So this is one of the reasons that I'm always harping on the importance of sleep and stress management and cultivating pleasure, because these are all things that we can do to help our brain function better. So let's talk a little bit more about that. You have a question?
No, I liked your conclusion.
Okay, good. So there's three things that the brain needs, essentially: glucose, oxygen, and stimulation. And, you know, as far as stimulation goes, that's why people that stay mentally active, you know, as they get older, tend to age better and do a lot better than people who don't, you know, who just kind of like sit on the couch and eat jelly beans and watch TV. And this is another reason why blood sugar regulation is so important. You know, when people come to see me in the clinic, you know, the first things that I'm looking for are oxygen deliverability and blood sugar regulation. Those are like the two deal breakers. And, you know, once again, here, as we talk about the brain, we see glucose and oxygen being two of the main things that it needs. Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and other, you know, neurological conditions have been called diabetes of the brain. That's, you know, kind of one of the newer theories about it. And of course, this also illustrates why stress management is so important. We've got studies show that cortisol rhythm maintains blood sugar stability. So if cortisol doesn't go down, you get insulin resistance. And if it goes too low and can't come up, you get hypoglycemia, which is a total disaster for the brain. And then we know that elevated cortisol also damages the hippocampus, and that chronic stress atrophies the brain, literally atrophies the brain. And this is also why blood flow to the brain is so crucial, because blood carries oxygen and glucose and everything else we need to the brain. And you could almost say that blood flow equals function. So, one of the, you know, two of the best ways to increase blood flow to the brain are exercise and acupuncture. And actually, I wrote a whole series about, I believe that the main, one of the main reasons that acupuncture works is that it increases blood flow. That's, you know, kind of like a Western understanding of how it works, but I think it's one that there's a lot of support for that. And it's been proven to increase blood flow to the brain. And so anyone with a brain gut axis issue should definitely be trying acupuncture and on a pretty regular basis. And then there are certain nutrients, botanicals like feverfew, ginkgo, cayenne, and then some limited research suggests that vinpocetine from periwinkle can increase blood flow to the brain. And then you, of course, would have to deal with any anemias that are present, which is a compromised oxygen deliverability, the inability or the impaired ability of hemoglobin to deliver oxygen to the tissues, including the brain. And I see anemia, I think anemia is one of the most underdiagnosed and misdiagnosed conditions there is, because I see anemias in, 30 to 40% of my patients, and they're almost all unaware that they have it. And their doctors haven't told them anything about having it. And, you know, if they see low hemoglobin, they just give them iron, even if iron deficiency is not the cause of anemia. But, that's a whole other issue. And then stress management. It just keeps coming back to this. It's things like mindfulness-based stress reduction, Jon Kabat-Zinn's programs, Feldenkrais, yoga, Qigong or Tai Chi, whatever it is for you. I mean, different people have different things that work for them. It's super important to integrate this into your life. And you notice that I'm not saying stress reduction or stress elimination, because, in the modern world, most of us don't have that luxury or option. So, stress management is the key. Regarding the gut, we've talked more about this in other podcasts, but, a gut healing protocol might include the GAPS diet, glycine-rich bone broths and probiotics and prebiotic foods like sweet potatoes and Jerusalem artichokes and stuff like that. And then you've got botanicals like marshmallow root and slippery elm and chamomile and Spanish moss that can be helpful. And if there's a pathogen, you should address that. But really, like, at least in terms of this episode, I'm focusing more on the brain, because I think that's the part that most people are missing more. There's a lot out there on how to heal the gut, but not that much on how to heal the brain. I mentioned before that when the microglia cells become activated, it's hard to turn them off. There are some nutrients that have been demonstrated to do that, including curcumins like turmeric, skullcap, green tea extract. And in terms of healing the blood-brain barrier, you've got alpha-lipoic acid, glutathione, which you need to take things that help glutathione synthesis. You can't take just oral glutathione. It's not effective. And then omega-6, omega-3 balance is actually crucial in maintaining blood-brain barrier integrity. So, don't go out and just buy all this stuff and come home with a shopping bag of supplements. try to find someone who can help with this and focus your efforts. It's definitely worth doing, because it's really important, pattern to manage. So let's do it.
And SpectraCell will actually measure the amount of glutathione in your blood, correct?
I don't know about that test.
I had it a lot. I don't know if it's totally bunk or not, but I remember receiving it, and they didn't tell me that it measured it, but I got it back, and it was cool.
Mm-hmm. I'm always naturally skeptical, as you might imagine, of those those kind of tests, but anyways, I don't know anything about it, so I can't really say. So let's take a couple Let's do a couple questions. I know we're getting, you know, we had a long episode last time. I don't want to go too far this time, but let's take a few questions, and then I have a couple things to end with.
All right, cool. This one, I believe, was on your Facebook page, but it's from Stephanie Alexander. I would like to understand the connection between acute emotional stress and the onset of gut issues and the progression to additional health issues.
Okay. Well, you know, I think probably we've covered that mostly, but, you know, early studies suggested that a stressful event would trigger hormonal and neuronal reflexes that in the brain that influence the gut, and that does happen. But recent reports have also shown that the gut produces the same stress peptides that are present in the brain and the central nervous system. And these peptides regulate intestinal motility, which is the rate at which digestive material passes through the intestine. So we're getting back to, you know, that extreme fear stress event that causes diarrhea. During a stressful event, the normal amount of those peptides gets totally thrown out of whack, and that affects digestion and motility. And when that happens repeatedly over time, it can evolve into a gut-brain axis disorder like IBS or IBD.
Awesome. The next question, kind of a two-prong question from Lisa Rose. I would love to hear your take on probiotics. Should everyone be taking them, or can it do more harm for some? Which brands do you recommend, and the role enzymes play to help digest food while the gut heals? Also highlighting the power of foods for a healthy gut, like fermented foods. What other foods help? And then an additional question from Laura that's kind of in the same vein. Should people with healthy gut digestion take probiotics? What happens if you take too much? How do you determine the right amount?
I don't see any need for healthy people to take probiotic supplements, but I think incorporating fermented foods into your diet is a good idea for everybody. Just as a, you know, number one, it tends to help with digestion. Number two, it can just help normalize the gut flora and protect us against overgrowth of pathogenic bacteria or, you know, parasites or that we might take in through food. Number three, they're tasty and I like them. number four, they tend actually to have even more microorganisms in them than a lot of the commercially available probiotics. Number five, I think some common sense and maybe studies suggest that they are more likely to survive the stomach acid and, you know, make it to the colon, which is where they're needed. So I don't typically recommend that, you know, probiotic supplements as a matter of course. I do recommend probiotic foods. So we're talking about, you know, dairy ferments like kefir and yogurt and creme fraiche and, you know, fermented cream, which that basically is creme fraiche, but there are different ways to do it. Then you've got fermented vegetables like kimchi and sauerkraut and sauerrüben and, fermented beverages like beet kvass. It's a great book called Wild Fermentation by Seymour Katz that has like every possible fermented food you could imagine and how to make it. Full Moon Feast by Jessica Prentice is really great for that too. And as is Nourishing Traditions by Sally Fallon from the Weston A. Price Foundation.
Yeah, food, not pills.
Yeah, and I use probiotics and prebiotics therapeutically in my practice for sure, because for some people, the food doesn't seem to be enough. So
totally. Yeah. Totally. Okay, the next one's going to be from Mike Zemrose. Please discuss psychosomatic reactions to food and how this complicates diagnosis of gut-related problems.
I'm not totally sure what he means by psychosomatic reactions to food, but, you know, I'll take a guess. The Chinese have a great saying. I think I mentioned this before when I wrote the article on the 80-20 rule, which is that it's better to eat the wrong food with the right attitude than the right food with the wrong attitude. And, you know, of course, it's best to eat the right food with the right attitude, but that's not always possible, or it doesn't always happen that way. And this is in part why I do suggest an 80-20 rule or 90-10 rule for most people. And for those of you who don't know what that is, that means that 80 or 90% of the time you eat, you know, paleo plus, you know, raw dairy type of diet, whatever you want to call it, the perfect health diet, paleo 2.0, you know. And then the other 10 to 20% of the time you eat, you know, whatever you want. And for a lot of people, whatever they want still just is the paleo, that type of diet. But some people, you know, some might have a food like that they really associate with happy times during, you know, when they were a kid, or, you know, that just they're out with friends, they want to get some ice cream or whatever. And the pleasure that experience can create, and the stress and kind of feeling of deprivation and stuff that can prevent, will actually, you know, according to this Chinese saying, is actually better, you know, will have a more beneficial effect on the body. So I think that's a good rule to follow if you're generally healthy. I mean, if you're gluten intolerant or celiac, for example, you don't get the 80-20 rule with gluten, with bread. You know, it's 100% zero. You never get to have it. But anyways, back to the question. There was an interesting study where they hypnotized patients and put them into four different emotional states: relaxation, anger, happiness, or excitement. And then they observed the gut after they ate. And relaxation and happiness increased the distension volume required to produce discomfort, meaning that, you know, going back to this, that we were talking about IBS and hypersensitivity, that when people are relaxed and happy, they're less likely to experience discomfort while eating. And then when the patients were angry, it decreased the distension volume that was required to produce discomfort. So, you know, I don't think this is a surprise to anybody that when you're happy and relaxed, you're going to digest your food better. And when you're angry, you're not. But you know, it's definitely in the scientific literature. How we feel when we eat alters the secretion of hormones and peptides and neurotransmitters, and that affects not only our digestive function, but also things like cardiovascular function. Dr. Malcolm Kendrick talks about this. He says that, he points to some studies in his book, The Cholesterol Con, that postprandial or after meal stress is one of the most significant risk factors for heart attack. So those French, you know, that have those leisurely 2-hour meals, they know what they're doing. Whereas here, you know, we eat and then like we're eating in front of the computer, and then, or we're like chomping down an egg McMuffin while we're, you know, changing lanes on the freeway or whatever. You know, that's kind of a disaster.
Well, speaking of the French, our next question is from Pierre Brade.
Pierre. Sorry, my French accent is so ridiculously bad.
Okay, his question is, I'm interested in how stress eating throws off the physiology/body chemistry, and how the brain-gut axis amplifies it, and what are some ways of resetting it caught in the cycle? Big question.
Yeah. I mean, I think we've pretty hopefully covered this and during the podcast, but I'll just mention a few. You know, stress eating, we haven't talked about particularly, like sugar and carbs and fat can mitigate the effects of stress by increasing opiates and dopamine, other neurotransmitters like serotonin that make us feel good and feel like life's okay and everything's going to be fine. But if you do this regularly during times of stress, that you can cause adaptations in those pathways that can lead to overeating. And other studies have shown that the food reward and sensitivity is decreased during stress, and that which leads to overeating. So in other words, when you're really stressed out, you don't actually enjoy the food that you're eating as much as you do when you're not. And then you keep eating because you're not getting that food reward that you're expecting. And then I don't know if you saw this, but Stefan Guillenet over at Whole Health Source wrote a post today. He published today about food reward that showed that mice eating chocolate Ensure, but not vanilla or strawberry Ensure. These are these elemental diet drinks that they give people that are just disgusting. I can't believe that mice would even eat them at all. It's surprising to me. But the mice eating the chocolate ensure could overeat and become obese, whereas the ones eating strawberry or vanilla didn't. So what this suggested was that the flavor of food actually influences body fat and body fat set point. So, and then the last thing is, I guess, we talked about this before, but elevated cortisol can lead to increased food intake. That's an evolutionary mechanism, probably designed to make sure that we get enough food to fuel our metabolic needs during times of stress, or, you know, maybe when a, you know, food shortage is on the way or something like that. So the way to deal with this is, as I said, to take steps to manage stress throughout the day and throughout the week, and to find other ways of coping with stress when it becomes overwhelming, aside from eating. And that, you know, that's a topic that's beyond the scope of, you know, we can't cover that in significant detail right now, so at the end of the show. But I think the key is to manage stress regularly so that you don't get to that place where you're just so overwhelmed that the only solution is a half of a chocolate cake.
Cool, Chris. Do you have anything else to throw in on the gut brain axes?
I don't think so. Do you have, did I miss anything? I'm sure I did.
No, I thought it was fantastic. You covered everything.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about this healthy baby home study course that's coming out soon, because I'm super excited about it. We actually renamed it. It's now called the Healthy Baby Code. And yeah, very, very secret code.
It makes me think of the History Channel's Bible code thing that I used to watch in high school.
The Da Vinci Code? No, it didn't exactly. Didn't have anything to do with that. But it's based on, so I was giving these live presentations, for those of you who aren't aware of this, on nutrition for fertility and pregnancy and breastfeeding. And they sold out. There was huge demand for them locally. And a lot of people on my blog and Facebook and Twitter were asking if I could make it available to people who didn't live locally here in the Bay Area. And it's a super important topic. I feel really passionate about getting the information out there. So what I did is I turned the presentation, which was about 3 hours, into this home study course. I actually expanded it considerably. And there's going to be 6 video modules. They're like screencasts from the presentation, covering things like, you know, just the basics on how proper nutrition contributes to lifelong health of your baby, which I just wrote a blog post on called The Developmental Origins Theory. You know, the sacred food, fertility foods that have been used by traditional cultures around the world. And then module 2, we talk about macronutrients, you know, like protein, fat, and carbohydrate. Not necessarily how much of each, but what type of each, which I wrote about my 9-step series and Kurt's talked about a lot. You know, find out which types of fat and carbohydrate and protein are best for you and your baby. And we talk about micronutrients, so essential vitamins and minerals, which ones are critical during the developmental period, during pregnancy, and also for fertility, where to find them in foods, and when it's necessary to supplement, and what dosage of each you might need to supplement with. And then in module 4, we talk about food toxins, which is, we learn about the 4 Neolithic agents of disease, which I'm sure many of you are already familiar with. Cereal grains, industrial seed oils, excess fructose, and soy, modern processed soy. And then in module 5, we talk about breastfeeding and first foods, which is a lot of people have questions about, you know, how long should you breastfeed? When should you introduce foods, and how do you introduce them safely to, you know, try to minimize the risk of food allergies and reactions and autoimmune conditions and stuff like that. And then in module 6, we kind of put everything together and into a focused strategy, you know, for really supercharging your fertility and promoting a healthy pregnancy and then raising a vibrant, healthy, beautiful baby. And of course, this is very my personal motivation for doing this too, because my wife's 6 months pregnant. We're expecting a baby in in July, and we had kind of a long road and, you know, difficulty conceiving at first. So my wife has autoimmune thyroid disease, and a lot of doctors just told us, you know, not even to bother. And of course that didn't sit well with me. So I did tons and tons of research in my typical obsessive compulsive way, and, you know, into what nutrients were really necessary to support a healthy pregnancy. And, you know, the magic happened last October and we conceived. So I'm really excited to share this with people. In addition to the video modules, which are, by the way, going to be transcribed into PDFs, because I know some people don't like video and they learn better by reading. I happen to be one of them. And then there'll also be MP3 recordings of each module. So if you like drive a lot and you want to listen to them in the car, you can do that. And then I've added a whole bunch of bonus stuff, which we're excited about. There'll be quick reference charts. So, like, you know, just easy to follow a nutrient chart that lists all the essential nutrients and, you know, what foods they're in and what dose to supplement with if you need to. There'll be a 2-week meal plan, which both my wife and I work pretty hard on, from collecting recipes from places like HealthBand and Cheese Slave and the Paleo Diet Lifestyle, a lot of great recipes on the web, and then our own recipes. We're not too shabby cooks ourselves. And then there's going to be an interview of frequently asked questions with me, some of the most, you know, frequently asked questions about nutrition for fertility, pregnancy, and breastfeeding and stuff. And there's going to be a list of recommended supplement brands, dosages. And then, of course, wouldn't be complete without some stress management, because that's obviously a huge factor for women trying to get pregnant and women who are pregnant. And my wife, Elan, is a Feldenkrais practitioner and has also done a lot of somatic experiencing training, which is a particular approach to dealing with stress and trauma. So she is doing some, recording some stress management audio programs for women who are trying to get pregnant, and men for that matter, and then women who are pregnant and breastfeeding. So that's the whole kit. And now you can see why I've been working so hard.
No, yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, so that's going to hopefully be available in, like, I want it to be available in 2 weeks, but, you know, maybe more realistically 3 weeks. And, you know, and please don't shoot me if it's the end of May, but working as hard as I can to get it out there. And so if you're not already on the list for this, you should go to growahealthybaby.com. That's the old name for it, but that's where the sign up list is. I know it's a little bit confusing. It's kind of in transition to the new name, but if you go to growahealthybaby.com, you can sign up to be on the email list to be notified when it's released. And one reason to be on that list is that I'm going to be making a special offer to people that are on that list. We're going to do kind of like a beta launch or a seed launch, you know, a smaller launch just to that list. Kick the tires a little bit, and in exchange for people's feedback, we're, you know, I'm going to offer some pretty cool stuff to people on that list. So make sure to join that if you're interested in this, and pass the word on to folks that you think might be interested.
Awesome. You can find all my insanity at DannyRoddy.com. Keep sending us your questions at thehealthyskeptic.org using the podcast submission link. Chris, what a great episode. Thanks. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, I had fun. And thanks, everyone. we'll talk to you. Wait, who next week are we doing? Is it Chris? No, wait. Is it Stefan? I don't know.
The May 20th is Master John.
And well, then, we got some exciting episodes coming up. We've got Chris Master John. We're gonna bring cholesterol into the 21st century. Finally, it's awesome. Gonna be like, you know, the fully up to date integrated understanding of cholesterol, all the latest research, and you know, cut through the hype and the confusion. And you're finally gonna understand this whole cholesterol thing. And then Stefan Guillenet is gonna come back and make it. second appearance. You know, we kicked the whole podcast off with him talking about obesity, and he has some very interesting newly developed theories about obesity and weight regulation that he is going to share with us, which I'm super excited about. So looking forward to that.
Awesome. Cool. That brings us to the end of the episode. Take care, guys.
All right. See you later. Take care of your brain gut.